from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Chris Loffrey, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our segments podcast. Here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage. Monday was the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. It was the largest extermination camp run by Nazi Germany in occupied Poland during World War II. More than a million people were murdered there. Today, only a handful of survivors are still alive. Patrick Hicks is an author and writer in residence at Augustana University. He joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh for a discussion.
Patrick, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's always my pleasure.
Everyone has a story of sort of the first time that they heard about these places, these death camps, extermination camps. Your story goes back to childhood, and I'm hoping that you can tell it a little bit now today, even though you've written about it before, because it also ties into some other things that are happening today socially. Is you thought one thing, and then you woke up and thought something else, even as a young child.
Yeah. I remember I was pretty young, maybe 9 or 10 years old, when I saw footage for the first time of the Holocaust. And it was not of Auschwitz. It was these black and white video footage that I now know was taken by the British Army at Bergen-Belsen. But it was these really now iconic photos of the bulldozers, moving these emaciated skeletal bodies into these massive graves. And that really shook me as a 9 or a 10 year old. And, you know, at that point in time, we're talking about the late 1970s, the Holocaust was not that far removed from where I was in time, because I'm now 50. So it was really shocking to me that something like that could have happened in such recent history. And it really did change me. And it made me curious about how it could happen and curious about how we could make sure that it couldn't happen again. And it was really the beginning of a lifelong study of the Holocaust in general.
Because before that time, you as a little boy were kind of thinking, the aircraft, the swastika, these sort of like just a cool kind of, a cool thing to be fascinated with. And then suddenly you realized what it all meant and how it fit together with cruelty and evil and what we're capable of.
Yeah, I was one of these nerdy kids that, I was building like model airplanes and things like that. And for me, at that point in time of my life, the German planes from World War II, they were just cooler. The Germans, they invented the first jet aircraft, and they were sleek. And, so I really enjoyed building the aircraft. And I kind of knew sort of vaguely in the background that these awful things have been happening, but it wasn't until I was confronted by that visual proof that, it just fundamentally transformed everything for me. And I went from sort of admiring those planes from an aesthetic perspective of, aerodynamics and wow, they're really cool, to just being really repulsed by the war machine that they represent and the subsequent genocide that followed in their wake.
Tell us what happened on January 27th, 75 years ago. Where are we at in the war? And then the Soviet Army comes to liberate this camp. Did we have any idea of what exactly the scope and the scale of what was going on there? Take us back to that time in history, if you would.
Well, at that point in time, January 27, 1945, when Auschwitz was liberated, it wasn't covered all that much. It didn't make much of a news splash, I suppose, because you have the Soviet army approaching from the east. And by this time, you have the Americans and the British coming up through Italy, but also now pushing with some speed from the Western Front, because D-Day happened only a few months previous to this. So you can see Germany is beginning to collapse and is beginning to sort of shrink, and the Soviet army is really pushing to get to major cities like Krakow in Poland, because if they can secure that city, that becomes a base for them, and clearly it's going to advance the Soviet mission of trying to take over and conquer the Third Reich. So the Soviets were not interested in liberating Auschwitz. They had very tactical and military objectives that they were trying to make. But while they were doing that, they did come to the gates of Auschwitz. And they had liberated previous camps in their march into the Third Reich and the occupied areas of the Third Reich, of which Poland certainly was. And when they arrived, the 322nd Rifles of the Soviet Army, when they arrived at the gates, the main gates of Auschwitz, they were absolutely horrified. They had not seen something quite like this before. The camp was liberated at about 3 in the afternoon. And when I say liberated, you know, we can't really think of the inmates and the prisoners as being jubilant. I mean, they were far too emaciated for that. Some 60,000 of the prisoners had been sent on a death march out of the camp several days earlier. So when the Soviets arrived, there were about 700 people, maybe 1,000 people that were in the camp itself. A number of bodies, they found an awful lot of discarded clothes. They found 7 tons of human hair. It was very shocking, you know, when they finally, and the crematoria had been all blown up, and the Nazis were trying to hide their crimes.
Let's talk a little bit about, we live in a time now where some of those survivors of Auschwitz and other places never speak of what happened to them. Others only recently have started speaking about it. But many of them are in, you know, who were children then, are, you know, elderly now, they're in their 90s. How important is it for people like you, people who don't have a direct, you know, connection to this time or place, to do some of the work that you've done, which means research, study, telling the story, and actually going there? And I want you to take us there in a second, but what's our moral obligation today when we think of Auschwitz in particular?
Yeah, and when we think of these camps, and Auschwitz is emblematic of the entire Nazi genocidal system for sure, but we're losing our survivors. I mean, the survivors that we have now, they were teenagers when the Holocaust happens, which necessarily means that their awareness of the world is different. You know, they didn't have children, for example. They had yet to start careers. So the survivors that we do have, and they're in their 90s at this point in time, their recollection of these places is just going to be a little different from, say, if you were to interview someone in the 1970s or in the 1980s who was, you know, maybe in their 40s when they had survived. So it becomes vital that we sort of have people and institutions that can carry this dark knowledge forward, because a time is going to come, maybe sometime in the next 10 or 15 years, where there'll be a headline where last Holocaust survivor dies. And I wonder and I worry about what that means for the legacy of the Holocaust itself.
All right. You have been to these places in your research for the books that you have written and your forthcoming book as well, have been about this period in history. Tell me a little bit about going to Auschwitz. When were you there and what was that like?
I'd been to a number of camps before I got to Auschwitz. I'd been to, for example, I'd been to Bergen-Belsen and to Dachau. And it was hard to see these places for sure, but those two camps reside in Germany. And I now sort of feel that, you know, it's necessary, obviously, that these camps are preserved, but they're very sort of sterile. And most of the original buildings had been torn down, especially in the case of Bergen-Belsen. So when I got to Auschwitz for the first time, I sort of mentally prepared myself, like, you've been to a place similar to this, and it will be hard, but you'll be okay. And being at that place, I believe it changed me, and I think it kind of changed me on maybe even on a molecular level, because it's one thing to study that camp, but it's an entirely different thing to stand on the ramp where the families were separated and to see the ruins of the gas chambers and the crematoria. And I left Auschwitz for the first time because I'd spent about 30 hours doing research there. And I left after that first sort of stint of doing research. And I went back to my hotel room and I closed the door and I just burst into tears. And I'm not prone to that. I'm not ashamed of that. But I was surprised by the level of grief that overwhelmed me. And I've returned to Auschwitz several times since then. And that sense of, it's hard to quantify the enormity of what happened there. It's you feel very small when you're walking around the place.
Other people come and take tours, and I was reading an interview with one of the tour guides who you know spoke openly about one of his concerns is that once people come and visit and light a candle and say that there's a risk of checking it off the list. I remembered, I paid my tribute. It's time to move on. For people who lived through this and for people who return to it, there's that's not the case. How do we continue to carry on, you know, that knowledge, that history, into the decisions that we make on a daily basis? It, like you said, it's just the scope of it is so overwhelming sometimes, all the time.
It is. And I'm aware that it's International Holocaust Remembrance Day, but given the work that I do, you know, every day is International Holocaust Remembrance Day for me, which I think is a good thing, because when I see the disadvantaged and the dispossessed in my own, not just country, but my own corner of the world, I'm more likely to speak up, for example. You know, if I was to see, say, a flyer that was promoting white supremacy, you know, I'd take that down with no problem, tearing that down, for example. And I think, you know, if there's a lesson about the Holocaust that we should take with us on a daily basis, it's that idea of confronting hatred directly when we see it.
Mm. Early.
Early, and not just kind of shrugging our shoulders and saying, you know, well, there's just some bad apples here, and you know, this is causing pain to other people in our community and our country, and it's, I think, our obligation to stand up and to confront that when we see it happening.
Right, because people want to say never again, this should never happen again, but in China right now, a million Muslims are in internment camps, and you have examples from recent history that are horrific as well, of genocide and you know, targeted evil inflicted upon certain people. What are some ways that we continue to fail in humanity to stop those things?
I think it's easy to sort of look at sort of what's happening and kind of turn away. You know, one of the phrases that Hitler used that I'm aware of, he called the press the Lügenpresse, the lying press. And you know, there's that echo today that I hear from our politicians. And I find that very, very worrying. And, you know, we have people in cages on the border, and I find that very worrying. And I think that these are things that, you know, that we should just be sort of aware of, and not to look at the Holocaust as, that's something that happened in the past. And as you say, I check off the box there and I don't need to worry about it. I think that the Holocaust nudges us and should frustrate our comfort level with the current society that we live in.
Mm. Tell me, have people told you their stories? Have you been in the presence of survivors who have told you how they survived, who didn't survive, how they feel about their time in the camps?
Yeah, I've had the really good fortune, really the honor of interviewing some of the people that survived. And it's really, you know, I feel, you know, how do I encapsulate that? I'm just aware that each survivor is different. Right. Each survivor had a different sort of experience. You can be a Holocaust survivor, but not necessarily a survivor of a camp, for example. Maybe you evaded capture, which is equally as horrifying. Maybe you survived a ghetto. But I think that with the Holocaust, what I find is sort of universal in the people that I've talked to directly and with survivors that I've had the opportunity to watch maybe on interviews or in documentaries, is that they all really come to the same conclusion that the Holocaust is a wound that has never healed for them. They've just learned to carry it with them and to be aware that it like any form of trauma, it will always be there. And the question is, well, how do I now go and live a life of meaning and worth?
For in your research, for the people who inflicted, you know, the people who ran the executions, is there a residual trauma to there? It has to damage someone's soul as well. I'm not sympathizing with them, but I'm wondering what you've learned in your research to say what happens to people who are on the other side of something like that.
The perpetrators?
Yes.
And here we get into some muddy waters, because the Germans made the Jews at Auschwitz, because it was overwhelmingly the Jews that were murdered at Auschwitz. They made they're called the Sonderkommando, and they made them not put the gas in the chamber, but they were the ones that had to get the bodies out and to take them on. So those almost predominantly men, they were scarred obviously for the rest of their lives. But there's a really good book about the Nazi perpetrators themselves that were involved in something called the Einsatzgruppen. And these were, you know, shock squads that went out and they would gather up the Jews and shoot them in the forest. And it seems to be that there's this sense that, you know, that was the good old days. And if there is a sense of remorse, it's not expressed. And I'm no psychologist, but I find that really horrifying that these men were, many of, you know, we talk about the Nuremberg trials, but very few Nazis were actually put on trial. It was mostly the upper echelon. Many of them just went back and they became bankers and accountants and, you know, pharmacists or what have you, and they were able to get on with their lives. Hmm. And there was no justice, and they didn't speak about it, and it didn't seem that what they did bothered them very much.
The fusion of blues, soul, punk, and folk bleeds through Devin Sant's songs. Sant joined Lori Walsh on Monday for a live taping in our South Dakota Community Foundation studio in Rapid City.
Devin, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I don't do a lot of interviews, so it's very exciting to be here.
All right. Well, let's start out, before we play a little music, just talking about your background a bit. What are some of the things that you think are really important as a songwriter before we talk about performing? When you kind of consider your own creative process, do you have a sense of, you know, what you put first? What do you lead with?
I like to just be honest and tell the truth, you know, whether it's a part of you or you're telling someone else's story or whatever you're writing about, wherever your influences come from. You just got to be true to yourself and be true to the audience. I think that's the most important thing, because people can always tell a fake. So when you're telling a story, you got to make sure that it's your own, and that's what I like to share, is usually just my experiences through song.
Does that come naturally to you, or is that something that you have to get through? Like, you've done your first, you know, your first draft, as it were, and then you think, you know, that's the part that I'm not there yet. I can be more authentic here.
I think it depends on the story I'm trying to tell. Most of the time it comes very easy, but sometimes there's things I've been through, and when you go to sing about it, you have to take a step back until you're kind of just ready to tell that story. And sometimes it happens on its own. A lot of times when I perform, I'll sing a song and I'll ad-lib things in that happened in story I'm telling and that aren't really in the song. And that kind of happens a lot more than not. So I think that's the most important thing. You know, I had a chance to watch Blue October many, many times. And the one thing he's always kind of said is to just write your own songs and play them to who will listen. And that's kind of been my, I don't know, inspiration for songwriting.
And you are unafraid to bring some of those darker aspects of yourself to your music. Is there a point is the music helping you get through that part of your life or that experience that might be more painful? Or do you have to get through that part and then you're ready to put it into song? How do those two things intersect?
Well, for me, that's definitely how I got through it in a lot of cases. Without music, there's no way I'd be here. Since I was in eighth grade up until a couple of years ago, actually since I moved here, I struggled with suicide like my whole life. And without music, I would not have made it through.
Music literally saved your life.
Yeah, multiple times. Whether it was something I was writing or something somebody else had written, and I'm just singing along to it. There's just always been kind of this outlet for this emotional outlet that I couldn't find anywhere else, and that's really what I connect with in songwriting. So,
yeah. And then immediately when you're performing music, other people are going to mirror that back to you, and you become part of this circle of where, you know, your musicians have been your friends, even though if you didn't know them, now you become that friend for somebody else who just happens across one of your songs. Do listeners ever come to you and say, that song, that helped me in some specific way?
Actually, yeah. This was last year. I was playing a gig over at the Loud American in Sturgis, and this guy came up to me, and he just wanted to thank me for writing a certain song. Yeah. And he just said, you don't know me, you don't know what I've been through, but I needed to hear that in my life. I have never seen that guy again, but and hopefully it helped him in some way.
Yeah.
That was part of the coolest experience for my gigging career to date. So. Yeah.
And in that moment, it helped him. Whatever happens next, you know the truth of that moment.
It did. Yeah, so that was really cool.
Yeah.
And that's actually the first song I'll play, too. It's a song I wrote called I'm Not a Hero. And it's just all about dealing with and accepting your personal darkness and demons. I like to talk about that stuff a lot because it's real. We all have it. And when people don't talk about it or kind of hide from it, I think that it doesn't make them any stronger, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead and play that. This is Devin Sants here on Moment in Sound on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I keep my darkness close to me, 'cause it's not my enemy, oh no. I'm not a hero. All these words in my head, they've all been said before. Like, why am I here? And what do I stand for? I tell myself I'm free and stand for something, but I know deep down inside I stand for nothing. I keep my darkness close to me, 'cause it's not my enemy, oh no. I'm not a hero. I've done things you won't believe. You wouldn't even recognize me, oh no. I'm not a hero. I embellish stories sometimes, and I'll do it again. I fooled people that I love and gave up on my friends. There's something going down when every sad song's hitting home, when you're out late with your friends but you still feel alone. I keep my darkness close to me, 'cause it's not my enemy, oh no. I'm not a hero. I've done things you won't believe. You wouldn't even recognize me, oh no. I'm not a hero. Don't say a prayer for me, don't shed a single tear. I'm getting what I deserve, now let me disappear. If I am just a ghost, then I want you to know, I let my demons be, I'm not a hero. Keep my darkness close to me, 'cause it's not my enemy, oh no. I'm not a hero. I've done things you won't believe. You wouldn't even recognize me, oh no. I'm not a hero. I can always feel the pain, but it never outweighs my shame, oh no. I'm not a hero. I'm not a hero. I'm not a hero.
Devin Sants on listener-supported SDPB Radio. His first EP is called Mess I've Made, and a single out as well, Home. Other projects are in the works. Tell us a little bit about that process of bringing something, to stage and then recording it and then trying to figure out, you know, what does this look like altogether? How do you sort that out?
For me, bringing it to the studio is actually harder than bringing it to the stage, because when I'm on a stage, I can own it. I could put all that raw emotion into what I'm doing and that feeling and get everybody knowing what I went through. And it's really hard to do that when nobody can see you.
Right.
So when it comes to the studio, I try to think of different things from, do I want more instruments involved here? What would I try to get other people's opinion. I have a couple of musician friends I'll send things to, like, hey, what do you think would sound good here? And so that's kind of where Home came from. It was the first full band kind of recording I did. And that was a single I did here in Rapid City. And that really came out well. So yeah. It's definitely harder for me to do than I think other musicians.
So you were featured on Heath Johnson's podcast, The Heath Bar. And I'm not going to steal Heath's material up here, but you guys have a really great conversation about bad songs that just did not work out. But talk a little bit, if you will, and I recommend that people go listen to the full podcast and the full conversation because Heath does a great interview. There is a sense of being willing to write something that sucks. That's even in your mind at some point later on, you're like, man, I can't believe I wrote that. But then it turns into something better, or it goes away forever.
So I'm Not a Hero came from another song, and there were a few good lines in there that I went back and stole because I was like, this song just is horrible. And I finished writing it, and I never really played it. But those two lines that were really good in there, and that was, I keep my darkness close to me. That was the chorus line, and that became a whole other song. So sometimes when you write these bad songs, it's just something you have to do in order to move on to the next best thing.
Yeah.
And I think we all kind of go through this. And, you know, being on the Heath Bar, that's really easy to have a conversation with Heath, because we have good chemistry and we know each other. But he has beer when we're doing interviews, and that's just a cool thing to
do. We'll take note here on Moment in Sound. Adding beer will always help. But I think a lot of young artists need to hear that, you know, because sometimes you do something that flops. And even if nobody ever sees it, but you've got it written down on the page or you heard yourself, you know, do it out loud, and you're like, oh my gosh, that can shut some people down. How did you learn to sort of push back that and trust the process that says, no, I'm a great artist. I'm a good artist. I'm getting better. I'm learning how to do this. When you were in your younger days, at some point you have to get over being bad in order to get good.
Oh man. And then the thing that got me over it, I think, is I played a song I was not proud of, and I was just kind of, I had been playing all day and my buddy was sick, so I just had to play more material, and we couldn't play covers at this particular venue. So I was like, I'm just going to pull from old material that's not good. And I played this song and everybody liked it. And I was like, what? I trashed this song on purpose. And, this lady is my friend Chris Husengates, his mother, Kelly. She really liked this song called City Lights, and I never play it. And I played it at the songwriter rounds because I was just kind of goofing off or whatever, and now I brought that song back and I found new inspiration. I've tweaked it a little bit. So sometimes you just need feedback from other people to get over bad songwriting.
And we already learned when Chris was on Moment in Sound that Chris's mother knows. So if Chris Husengay's mom says something is good, she has taste, apparently.
My suggestion to anybody out there who has written anything they're not proud of, or they think it sucks, or whatever the case may be, play it for other people and see what they think. Multiple people. And just keep playing it. And you could even start off, hey, this song sucks, but I'm going to play it anyway. And then it just kind of becomes, even if it's just a joke, it's still a fun thing to do.
Right. You know? What is it that you like about it? And then try to keep that.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit on your guitar strap. You have pineapples here. So for radio listeners who can't see the pineapples, this is part of, you know, your onstage expression. Why pineapples?
I actually even have a pineapple tattoo on my left leg. And really for me, pineapples are just a reminder to be true to myself, remember where I came from, know my roots, different things like that, and never take life so seriously, and always try to have fun with whatever it is you're doing. So that's what pineapples mean to me.
Yeah.
I actually got that whole theme and idea from my favorite TV show called Psych, and that's kind of the logo for their stuff is pineapples, and it just stuck with me. It just resonated really well with who I am as a person.
Yeah. Art that resonates.
Yeah.
There you go. What will you play for us next?
The next song I will play, I'm going to play a song called Dancing with the Devil. It's a little bit about different things in life, like church, and how some things don't work out for certain people, so you want to just go for it and jump off the deep end a little bit. And I've definitely done that more than once in my life. And it was on my single, or my EP that was out, but it's going to be on my full band album, and there'll be a full band version. It's going to be way different than what anybody's ever heard when it comes to this song. And it's just one of my favorite songs to play because it's kind of controversial, and sometimes, you know, you start playing this darker stuff and it puts people on the edge of their seat, and I like doing that to people. So
Devin Sands on Moment in Sound.
I was 8 years old. Well, I've been doing what I'm told. I went to church and I went to school, and boy, was I such a fool. I've been a slave to my shallow and stubborn ways. Straight and narrow for far too long. Well, now it's time for me to do some wrong. Sell my soul. You won't see me around here no more. I'm gonna walk this wicked road, 'cause I've got nowhere left to go. Spend money, drive fancy cars. I'm gonna write my name in the stars. Well, I'm tired of always doing what's right. I'm gonna dance with the devil tonight.
Devin Sands on Moment in Sound on SDPB Radio. Wow, thank you so much for that. It's fun to listen to, and it's challenging to listen to for some people. Are you having fun?
Yeah, I'm having fun.
Yeah.
You know, that's the song I always kind of put in towards the beginning because it helps break the tension and show people what I'm about a little bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm having a good time.
Yeah, and I mentioned before, like, you know, pick a genre. How do you describe that? Do you care how people sort of describe your music as long as they show up for the show?
Yeah, I
for
really
the show?
Don't care.
Yeah.
My friend Chris, he likes to say I'm bluesy, devil blues and stuff like that, and so I just go with that. But yeah. If I had to pick a genre myself, I guess it would be bluesy, folk, rock, I guess.
All right.
I don't know.
So when you have a notebook that you write down, do you carry a notebook with you?
All the time.
All right. So tell me a little bit about that process, you know, for especially for young artists who are trying to figure out, like, you know, I have ideas, I forget them, I have an idea, I don't know what to do with it. Walk people through on how useful a notebook and that creative capturing can be.
Okay, so I actually get a lot of flack about carrying around a notebook because we live in a modern age and they're like, dude, just use an iPad or whatever. And so for me, handwritten is just, I don't know, there's just something about it that's calming, and I really just can put my thought process on the page where I can scratch out things here right above it, different ideas right next to it, or I can't do that on when I'm typing. It has to be, when I'm typing, I feel like it's formal, it's the final draft, and I don't really like to think of any of my music as the final draft. Because I could always come up with something else that's like, oh, maybe if I just changed this word. And, you know, something Paul McCartney and John Lennon have both said is every word should mean something. If you change one word, it can change a whole song. So to me, it's very important to have that notebook and have that freedom, really. Yeah. To write on all the pages or doodle and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, my process, sometimes too, I will record ideas like just on a recorder or a recorder on my phone, write it down on my notebook and just play it real quick. That way I don't forget it. So I'm very forgetful when it comes to how licks go and different things. Like, what was the tempo of that?
What
key was that in?
That was great.
I forget
all the time. What was it? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like oh, that idea is gone now. Oh, well.
Yeah, but there'll be another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, don't let anybody give you flack. I know we live in a modern age, and you can type everything out or voice record everything, but handwritten notebook to me is just part of my process.
Right. Talk a little bit, if you would. I'd love to hear just how, you know, we've talked a lot about, on this show on Moment in Sound, about the culture of music and the arts in the Black Hills particularly, but in Sioux Falls, in South Dakota. And I'm always fascinated by, because I don't know that how many artists really think about what they're contributing to that music culture. They kind of see how they, you know, they fit into it and how it intersects, but they don't necessarily think about the imprint that they're making. And I often can see it very clearly. Like if you get up and sing, somebody else is listening and says, maybe, like, I haven't tried that kind of emotion, or I haven't done that with my voice, or I haven't, you know, who cares whether this is country or folk or whatever, I'm just going to do it. Do you get that sense that even, at, I mean, you're a young artist, but you're already contributing to the culture of a place just by standing on stage?
When it comes to contributing, just here in the Black Hills music scene, I think about that a lot, actually, about what am I doing on this stage that's different? What am I doing to help somebody in the audience? What am I doing to help my fellow musicians? And there's a couple different things I'd like to do. One, I promote everybody. It doesn't matter what genre. I like to throw them up on my Spotify. On, you know, if they have something new, I'll promote them on there or share their link on Facebook. So we like to lift each other up, I think, as a community amongst musicians. And then with the crowd, I think I bring a little bit of rawness, a little bit of this edgier kind of feeling to the stage that people don't really get around here. There's a lot of diverse things going on, but that raw and edginess, that dark kind of stuff, I don't think we have a lot of that up here. So I think that's what I bring to the table. And if you look at it like a wheel from punk rock to country, you know, we got everything in between. I think I just fit somewhere along one of those slots. So
right. Yeah, we can be so uptight. And that was one of the things that I appreciate about that last song. It was just like, oh, yeah, everything's going to be all right.
Oh, yeah.
You can just be yourself.
I didn't say it here because I'm not on a stage and there's no audience, but normally I say this song's about church and I just play that
and then
size
you just
to
go.
Start playing.
Yeah. Yeah. And everybody exhales and has a really good time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What will you play for us next here?
Well, I hadn't really prepared a set list or anything, but I think I'm going to end things with my latest single, Home. Yeah. It's a song I wrote about my grandfather and about Colorado, where I'm from. And it's just kind of means a lot to me. It's about advice my grandfather and my dad gave me, and just talking about your roots and being true to that and always staying true to that.
All right. Devin Sands.
As a boy, my granddaddy said to me, always be a man of integrity. Remember to be humble, and it's okay to get in trouble, as long as you're fighting for what you believe. My granddad might be gone, but his wisdom lingers on. His words help shape the man I've turned into. When I have children of my own, they will know his lessons too. And Grandpa, if you can hear me, this one's for you. The mountain air, I can taste evergreen. I can hear the echo of your memory being whispered in the trees. When I breathe the mountain air, I never 'cause when I'm in Colorado, I know that I'm home. When I was 14, my father said to me, I don't like liars or thieves. Work hard for what you want in life, and if you do something better, do it right. That's the kind of man I want you to be. My father's getting older now, but he's still young at heart. He's still there for me when life gets hard. I hope I was a good son, and I hope I make you proud. I hope I become half the man you are. When I breathe the mountain air, I can taste evergreen. I can hear the echo of your memory being whispered in the trees. When I breathe the mountain air, I never feel alone. 'Cause when I'm in Colorado, I know that I'm home. A piece of me is there amongst the mountain air, somewhere in Colorado. It's where I'll go to die. It's where I feel alive. Somewhere in Colorado.
We live in an age where science has answered so many big questions that many struggle to reconcile faith and science. Our next guest says, when we study science, it is not an absolute truth, just within the parameters of that experiment. When people make science the absolute ideal for all truth, they miss out on the broader idea of what it means to have something be true. Faith is rooted in the internal core of who we are as human beings. There is a reason we keep coming back to faith and religion. In the Moment continues its conversation about the future of faith in South Dakota today with George Sakaridis. He is a lecturer in philosophy and religion in the School of American and Global Studies at South Dakota State University. George earned a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Iowa State before pursuing theology in graduate school, first at the Dallas Theological Seminary and then at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, where he earned his doctorate in religion and science.
All right, so let's get started with just a little bit about where your interest is. How did you end up kind of following this idea of, you know, the intersection between, you know, science and faith, faith and pop culture, some of the things that you find interesting? What drew you to them?
Well, I think the honest answer is, you know, when you're a kid, you have a lot of different interests, and then you have to choose a career path. And as I chose a career path, I kind of just decided I'm going to include all of those things that I want to do. And so I was always interested in science. I wanted to be a scientist. My undergraduate degree is in electrical engineering. And somewhere along the way, I decided through various means that I wanted to go into theology and religion. And so I started down that path, but realized that I still liked science and I wanted to study it. So that intersection of religion and science, which was an active category in the scholarship, was a really viable option there.
All right. I'm going to jump in here because I also want to let listeners know that you're an actor. You have a podcast. You are involved in a lot of different things. And for some of us who are interested in so many different things, somebody's going to say, how do you have time? You know, how do you decide that day? What is the area that I'm going to follow? How do you make all these different parts of your personality and your personhood sort of find their expression in their life? So talk a little bit about that, if you would. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
That is a great question that I struggle with regularly, to be honest, because it does take a lot of time. And the more successful you become in one area, the more time it ends up taking, as you probably know. And I'm reaching some of that critical mass at times. But I schedule my time in such a way that, you know, I mean, I work a job at SDSU and I work on my scholarship. I work on my teaching. But, you know, some people go home and just watch TV or veg out. And sometimes I do that plenty, let me say. But at the same time, I also spend some of my off time or a weekend working on, you know, my creative work. And I've gotten plugged into a great network of independent filmmakers here in South Dakota and elsewhere in the country. And you just start to meet people who are passionate about the same things you are, and you work with them, and you build friendships. And my approach to networking is that I just try and make friends with people. And if it leads to work, that's great. But if not, then I made a great friendship. And that tends to be successful. And it really builds kind of an authentic relationship with people, and that leads to great work.
As an educator, then, you mentioned, you know, your undergraduate work in engineering and then transferring to this, you know, sort of what might have seemed to family members and friends as this completely divergent path. And now that you have students coming through, I'm sure some of them are rethinking, you know, why they ended up, you know, declaring a certain major. How do you sort of help people walk through the fact that it's okay to do the next thing that you're curious about?
Well, I think this is an issue of identity, ultimately, and I do some different work and think about identity quite a bit in religion and philosophy. And I think the paradigm is changing with the current generation where, you know, in previous generations, we were very tied to our job, and you were defined by your job. And due to economic factors and other social factors, we're now in a position where you can kind of define yourself based on your interests and your character and other things, and you're not just your job, to quote Fight Club, I guess, there. and I think that younger people are seeing that, and they're more willing to take a chance or be an entrepreneur or, you know, follow one career field, but then be an actor or a musician or something on the side that they can really be passionate about. And it makes them a better person overall. Because they're not one-dimensional.
And so then let's pivot to there being a time in generations past where you were identified by your faith or by your faith home, by the church that you went to. That was the epicenter of everything. And as time, I mean, where you ate dinner on a Wednesday night to where you got married to, you know, who you married, all these things were part of that, your identity, and that has shifted as well.
Yeah, significantly. And I think that's really touches on the divide we see in the present day between the idea of religion and spirituality.
Yeah.
That many people have rejected that idea of religion that is kind of structured and socially based. And it's, in some ways, I think many people have seen the hypocrisy of just doing or professing a faith that they don't necessarily hold to because that's the social standard and necessary for social means. And instead, kind of exploring spirituality and personal faith, and in fact, I'd say the current generation may even be more spiritual than past generations. They just aren't in those structures anymore.
Hmm. And how are scientific advances sort of folding into that and changing, you know, the way that we contemplate the universe, the way that we contemplate our own emotions as we learn about brain science, for example? How is science changing how we see our faith?
Well, there's a lot of directions I can go with this, so I'll choose one and we can work through it. But yeah, this is almost unlimited. Yeah. I think to touch on what you opened the segment with, science, people have looked at science as kind of the be-all, end-all of truth. And I believe science is true. It is great. I love science. Hopefully that's apparent from my history. But at the same time, it is set up hypotheses and observation, and it tells us what it's supposed to tell us. It tells us truth within a certain paradigm. So it isn't that it is not true, but it doesn't take into account everything in the universe. It only takes into account the natural order and certain experimental results. And even science is contingent, I always say. So it would be boring if it wasn't, because we have to keep trying new things, discovering new things. When we discovered quantum physics, or I should say, you know, maybe Albert Einstein did it, not me. But when it was discovered, that totally changed the paradigm of the natural order. And it wasn't that everything before it was false. We still study Newtonian physics, but it now was set in a different kind of framework. And so that framework is constantly changing. And so it's, I think, I hate to use the word, but arrogant to say that science has, you know, has discovered everything. Even scientists are still working through things. Religion and spirituality has always been with humans, and that is something that really touches on what it means to be human and who we are. And that works with science, but it doesn't have to work against science.
Right, because sometimes when it works against science, you have the sense of the things that we couldn't explain were the things that we attributed to, we being human beings, attributed to some divine order. And then when we learned that we could explain it in some, we understood the science better, that divine order gets smaller and smaller to the things that we can't explain. And I was listening one time to a news story about, they were talking about the God of the gaps, where if you just put God in the gap of knowledge, then when that knowledge fills in, your God was pretty small, it turns out. And that's not necessarily a useful way to compartmentalize science and our notion of God.
That's exactly right. And the idea of the God of the gaps, if science will continue to progress, so if your God is only the God of the gaps, those gaps will get smaller and smaller. And, you know, to use a mathematical term, you know, it's like a limit equation that goes to zero.
Yeah.
And so many people do see God that way. They say, well, science has eradicated the idea of God because it will and has explained everything. And I think we need to look at just life and the universe more holistically, and I don't mean that in like a new age way, but that science is a part of that, and it tells us a lot, but it doesn't tell us the whole story. And I think, to get back to the original question, the difference between religion and spirituality, for many, they've seen hypocrisy in religious systems, just personally and scientifically, as religion tried to converge with the scientific truth. And that was a mistake because it leads to the God of the gaps. And so I think spirituality, though, allows people to explore their own personhood in ways that are more broad. And I think that actually can lead back to traditional ideas of religion. It's just that right now we're going through that kind of transition.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about why people, return to faith, why human beings have a tendency to leave and sort of dismantle or deconstruct things brick by brick. And then when that deconstruction is done, have a tendency to build something else or not. Let's start with this idea of people coming back to faith and religion after an absence.
Well, like when I teach philosophy here at SDSU, I tell the students, I'm not trying to change your beliefs, but what I want you to do is, and I wouldn't say it exactly like this, but deconstruct your beliefs, look at them critically, and if you find you have the same beliefs, then now you have a more reasoned belief system and you can be more confident in it. And if you change, well, maybe those beliefs needed to be changed. Maybe there was a problem you were ignoring. And so I think when people deconstruct their belief systems, it should lead to a stronger faith if that faith is rooted in something substantive. So, I always have approached religion that if my own personal faith is true, then it's going to hold up to scrutiny. And if it's not, then there's probably a problem with it to begin with.
And then there are people. So this is, we're having a conversation that, is fairly thoughtful and I would even say intellectual. And there are other people that I know who are like, I can't articulate my faith. I can't tell you, I can't quote everything that you would need to know to defend this to someone who doesn't believe. And they're feeling that tension of just, believing something and knowing something, but not being able to explain that.
So what I would tell people is, and this is where I think science goes wrong, when you apply scientific methods to other aspects of life, it tends to create this very literal, modernistic viewpoint where people are afraid to express their faith because they don't have an answer for everything. And honestly, they shouldn't, because there aren't answers for everything that we have. But To go back to like an idea of, well, to quote it like, or to reference a philosopher, William James, and this is an American idea, that we're very pragmatic here, and experience matters. And so people can always share their experience. I can't invalidate your experience. I could choose not to believe it, but I can't say that your faith is false because, you know, because of these scientific reasons. You've experienced it. And so to you, that has a truth. And so I think people should start there and be willing to share their own experience and their own beliefs based on their who they are versus trying to conform to a scientific method that they really wouldn't have hope of living up to unless they've had years of training.
Yeah. Or a religious dogma? Are there parallels there?
Religious dogma, I mean, I think there are parallels because religious dogma still is at times a crude way to describe what is indescribable. Mm. And even if you look at, let's say, the history of Christianity, there are all these councils and creeds and attempts to explain who God is, and people recite those, and I think they're very valuable. But at the same time, language is still an approximation of what reality is, which sounds really philosophical, I know.
And but, yet it sounds very true. Doesn't that sort of resonate as truth? Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. I want to go back to this idea of spirituality versus, you know, religion. And when we talk about the future of faith in South Dakota, more and more people, you know, as a nation, we're becoming less Christian, in quotation marks, from Pew Religious Forum research.
Yes.
That fewer and fewer people are identifying with a certain faith, and there's a lot more of the nuns, N-O-N-E, as in people who have no religion or no particular affiliation. That seems to be growing, but yet we also often hear people talking about their spirituality or their, you know, their sense of wonder, their search for meaning. Do you think we're in a particular time in history? Is this something that has really always been going on? Are we on a wave of something? What are some of your initial thoughts on that?
Well, I do think we're on a wave of something, and history does, you know, ebb and flow with religious traditions. I mean, there's a long history of that. But I think the fact that people are drawn to spirituality, I would ask them, you know, why that is. It's pointing to something about the human experience, or perhaps the divine experience, that they can't quite put their finger on, but they want to explore. And they've found traditional religion to be lacking in explaining that. Mm. And so I think part of it is that traditional religions have failed many of the current generations that are around, you know, the millennials, Generation Z, et cetera. But at the same time, I think people will slowly move back to religion because they do crave that structure and that spirituality, and exploring it on one's own can only go so far, I think. I think we are drawn to structure. I think there's research that would show that.
Right.
Although it gets pretty complex.
Yeah. Do you think it will look significantly different than it does? You know, when we say they'll come back, are we thinking they'll come back to the same buildings and, you know, order of worship?
No, I think things will change for sure. And they are changing. We see in American Protestantism a high degree of, you know, divides and separations and people leaving the church. So in mainline Protestant denominations, they're, you know, quote, dying off because young people are not staying in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is because they have found the structures and the experience to be lacking. And I mean, I see a lot of, I mean, people always blame the church for hypocrisy. And I think there is a degree of that there. And I think as generations kind of grow and look to the future, they will come back, but they will hopefully correct some of the hypocrisies of the past. And what I tend to tell people about religion and structured religion is when you tie ideas of faith to power, that creates big problems. And I think we see that history in some major religious traditions, and most notably in the West, the Roman Catholic Church. When the papacy had a lot of state power, that created huge issues for Europe and the world. And I think that this sounds very American, I guess, but in many ways, religion, it should be democratic. It should be something that people can choose and experience on their own within those kind of guidelines and structures.
That's fascinating. And one of the other things is we have these conversations that I have been hearing again and again is how many faith leaders, faithful people, people who identify as Christian, have been coming in and wanting to talk about their faith as a way to speak up against how faith is being used as a power play in politics today. So, for example, you know, you have these more liberal-leaning Christians who are saying this, you know, I'm painting with a broad brush when I say liberal and conservative, but, you know, this conservative sort of, you know, legislation, for example, which is being argued from this viewpoint of, you know, this is the godly thing to do, or this is, you know, a faith-based initiative. That's not our faith. That's not our Jesus. That's not. And it seems like more and more people want to talk about their faith openly, at least on this program, as a way to say, to sort of remove some of that power as well. Faith and power is a really interesting thing to think about.
Yes, definitely. And I think one of the issues we have in America right now is that people have become so tied to their political affiliations that it actually has kind of superseded their religious beliefs at times. Hmm. And we see these kind of hypocrisies on both the right and the left. And I think that I'd like to think, and I think we do see the, like, Generation Z, the younger generation, coming up and seeing that hypocrisy and reacting to it. And that's typically what happens through history, is the next generation reacts to the previous one, and then, you know, corrects some things, but maybe swings too far the other way on other things.
Right. Sometimes it seems like Generation X just had nothing to say. Like, what happened to Gen X?
Is this a proud member of Gen X.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, where do we go wrong? Like, it's straight from boomers to millennials, and did we just completely drop the ball on everything? We checked out a little too much, George? I don't know.
I think we fell into a little, I'd like to think of it positively.
All right, help that, me.
Yeah, the boomers, you know, had, many of the millennials were born of boomers, although Gen X was too, in large part. And the millennials had it, you know, the bad, let's say the crude narrative is that the millennials had it good, and the boomers gave them everything and spoiled them, but at the same time the boomers messed up the political system and ruined their future. That's kind of the bad narrative that is out there right now, whereas Gen X kind of experienced the old ways of the boomers and the greatest generation, and yet they had some of the technologies and the good life of the millennials. And so we kind of fell in the middle and had this nice little pocket. And what it does for me is it finds me longing for, you know, my childhood. Yeah. And I mean, I'm writing a book right now on theology and the Americans, the TV show The Americans, which is set in the 1980s, and it's Soviet sleeper spies. And I just watch it.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
Nostalgically.
I haven't seen that yet, but yeah, I want to see that. Yeah.
Highly recommend it.
Let's talk a little bit about this pop culture and theology sort of intersection and why that's interesting to you.
Well, I think I can give you the personal answer is partly what I just said. I watch television, I watch movies, and I see things that move me. And I think as an actor and filmmaker and just as a human being, I am moved more by that sort of media than by academic discourse. And I think most people are. And I think that's a more powerful way to share your message. And so in part, I like doing religion and pop culture because it's a way to share these deeper messages through the media of the day. And people can then accept ideas without having to read dry academic arguments. And I think that's something academia has done very poorly throughout the years. Mm. But at the same time, it's a chance to just really enjoy and like write a book on something I like. So right now I'm also editing a volume on theology and Spider-Man.
Nice.
And it's just fun. I mean, I have a bunch of contributors who, you know, like Spider-Man, and they're thinking about deep theological issues of like sin and reconciliation, liberation theology, identity, just all these different ideas are coming up in this fun cartoon and movie set that everyone enjoys.
Yeah.
And so that both helps the culture, I think, by working through it, but it also kind of feeds our inner child and our creative streak and some really fun stuff comes out of it.
All right, and that brings us back to this idea that humans keep coming back to faith and religion in the sense that we can't even just chill out to Spider-Man without, you know, without looking at the deeper meaning and what it says about life. I mean, we're not necessarily just vegging out and consuming. You know, some days we are, but often we're not just consuming media, consuming books, movies, comic books, you know, blogs, podcasts. We're using that to inform the sort of living philosophy and theology that we are continuing to develop in the world.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And we're drawn to certain television shows or movies or ideas partially for entertainment reasons, but partially because it makes us think and it mirrors our own experience. And where I think media of any sort, it could be a book or a movie or a television show or a piece of art, we're really looking to see ourselves in that art. And so when we're drawn to art that kind of mirrors our experience, it helps us understand ourselves better because it's putting something into, I don't want to say into words, into visuals or into an experience that we can't always explain. And when we do that, it's very powerful. That's why art through history is powerful. And faith and art and religion and art are very tied together. Despite the fact that sometimes people try and separate those things.
Right. I was going to say, who has more power, the, you know, politics, the religious leaders, or the artists? But that's separation right there, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, the nature of that question is flawed.
Yeah, and it's tricky. And I think that's why being, you know, kind of a Renaissance person is important. I think it's important to do all these things that you love and are important to you, because it's expressing your holistic self. It's not just saying, well, I'm an academic, so I'm supposed to sit in an office for 12 hours and read books.
Yeah.
Which is great if that's what you love to do, and many people do. But I think it's good to balance that out in various ways. And I think people are more thoughtful than we sometimes give them credit for when they watch television or consume media.
Yeah. Is that maybe why, does that sort of help us understand why people get so upset when an actor, you know, speaks out politically, when, you know, Robert De Niro speaks out about President Trump and they say, you know, you're an actor, you know, stay in your lane, or, you know, a football player makes a political statement or an athlete makes a political statement, that we have, that some people have this natural notion that people should be compartmentalized into one thing or another. But in fact, you know, we're citizens, we're human beings, you know, we are creatures kind of walking around trying to figure out how to be in the world.
Yeah, I think that is accurate. And I think part of it is, let's say if Robert De Niro is portraying a character that you love and you see yourself in, and then he does something in his real self that is totally different than what you would do, you don't know how to maybe place that, because that character that you've attached to now has done something you cannot attach to. And that's something actually I'm just thinking now, but would love to explore that more. Yeah, I think there's more to that.
Right, and that goes to why people, you know, anyone, Jesus of Nazareth, going back and saying he would do this, but would I do that? You know, how people were off, you know, arguing on the floor of the state legislature about what would Jesus do in this situation, and people had very different answers about what the same person would do, and had their scriptural evidence for why they felt that way. There's something there to explore. Yeah.
Yeah, that goes down another rabbit hole. I mean, people tend with scriptures of any sort, but especially the Christian Bible in an American context, they tend to put priority over some texts over others.
Right.
And so when the text that you like is what matters to you, then you will kind of tout that, even though it maybe disagrees with a different text. And then you have these sorts of arguments.
Which is why some people are, you know, want to throw the whole bag in the garbage, whether they say, you know, everyone in Washington is corrupt, I'm not interested in politics, I'm done, or they say, I'm going to leave the church behind because I just can't handle, you know, this hypocrisy and this damage that you know, the church that I've been attending is doing in the world. And then you walk away, but you can't really, can you walk away? Can you walk away, or do you end up trying to seek meaning? Is there a good way to walk away and seek meaning in some other way?
Wow, that's a great question. I think there are probably many ways to do that. I mean, some people think change from within is best, to stay in the political structure or in the church and work to change it.
Yeah.
Others sometimes think a clean break is best and to reset in another way, in another place. But I think what's tough is, especially with faith and religion, is if something is tied very deeply to your identity from a young age, and you find it to be lacking later, you find it to be hypocritical, you're kind of fighting with yourself at that point. And so even though you know that maybe I should leave or maybe I should change something, you would have to admit that you were wrong or that there's something flawed in your upbringing. And many people have trouble doing that.
Yeah.
And I think probably all of us have trouble doing it, and some are more successful than others.
Have you seen Jojo Rabbit, the movie? Yet.
I have not. I have not yet.
So this is a 10-year-old Nazi. And of course, you know, coming of age and realizing, and it sort of expresses just what you were saying. And there's the scene in the movie. I don't want to spoil the ending, but it's historic. So we kind of know how it ends and that the Nazis are not going to stay in power. And there's a scene where he's just so conflicted, and he'd put these, you know, flyers up, you know, so this pro-Nazi propaganda up in town, and the city is under siege, and he's walking around trying to put the flyers back up, even though he's already kind of, you know, rejected Nazism. Mm-hmm. But there is this conflict, and this 10-year-old said, I cared so lovingly about this, and I managed it, I maintained it. It was my work. It was what I was living for, and now it's falling apart. And you just sort of watch this whole thing crumble and deconstruct around them. And there's people who are kind and people who are cruel. And it's a brilliant, brilliant film that sort of explores some of the things that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think that really touches on what we were just talking about and how people experience film, too. You may not be able to admit to yourself the kind of the flaws or the damage that has been done to you in your life. But watching it through a piece of art, it helps to register that in a more personal, internal way, because it's not you being attacked.
Right.
Someone else is being attacked. And through that attack on them, hopefully in a fictional sense, you then see the kind of the what is lacking in your own life. And so that's why movies move us so deeply.
That's so smart.
Yeah.
That's so smart. And the other thing about that movie is that it's really funny. You know, it's a comedy. And then at the end, this is my personal experience. I knew it was going to be sad. I had read some spoilers accidentally. And I went home. I could not stop crying. And I was like, I think it had something to do with the laughter, the fact that how many times that I sort of laughed uncomfortably and was primed emotionally to see these things were funny. I cried a little bit in the theater, and then I got in the car and I couldn't stop. And I was like, what has this filmmaker done to me emotionally? How did he put me in that space to where all this emotion is just pouring out all at once? Mm-hmm. It's really kind of a brilliant crafting of a film that really, you know, is pretty accessible. As a film, a lot of people would probably see it. It's not very academic.
Well, the best films, I think, are layered where, you know, there's a deeper meaning, but it's very accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
And I think the idea of laughter and sadness or crying being tied together is on the nose. I mean, that's correct. And we laugh at things sometimes because they do annoy us, or they make us sad, or they're incomprehensible otherwise, but we can laugh at them, and it helps to break that tension.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't know if I should give the example, but I was watching a movie when I was in college, and there was a very violent scene in this movie.
Yeah.
And I actually laughed. And the reason I laughed is so I wouldn't cry.
Mm-hmm.
Because there has to be some emotional utterance, and it also comes back to, you know, we're very emotional beings, and asking that question, what does it mean to be human? And art and science and all of these categories tap into that in different ways, and we should see the complexity of how that works, and not try and just say science has the full truth, or even art has the full truth. We have a very robust, you know, whole palette of colors to paint from, and we should, you know, enjoy all of them.
Yeah. I want to talk about your podcast, because when we talk about things that are accessible and funny, the television show Cheers, and I haven't listened to this yet because I was looking at it and I was thinking, I had that moment where you look at something and you think, what is this? And then you come back to it and you say, now that's interesting. And I think now I'll go back and I'll listen. But tell us a little bit about this podcast, please.
Okay. So it's called Cheers Weekly.
Okay.
And, we're on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle's Cheers Weekly Pod, and we're on iTunes, so that's all my advertising. But a friend of mine, Randy Woodbury, and I, we've known each other since freshman year of college. Mm-hmm. So more years than I want to admit on air, but a long time. And a few years back, we were talking about doing a podcast, and we both love Cheers. And no one had done a full Cheers podcast yet. And now there are a couple there are a couple others that have followed us. But we're on episode, I think, 110. And it's, you know, 30 to 40 minutes. Usually we talk about what we're watching on television and movies. We do some 80s nostalgia. Uh-huh. And actually that, again, that the reason, part of the reason I'm doing it, or at least what has come out of it, is I'm able to relive experiences as a child and a teenager through this podcast. And it brings back emotions and feelings that I hadn't even thought about for a while.
All right. Give me an example.
Oh man. Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of references on the show for me to WGN TV, because I grew up in the heart of Chicago. I grew up a little south of Wrigley Field, and it was in the '80s when Harry Carey, you know, was announcing for the Cubs and the whole thing. So the old commercials, just for Cheers and watching Cheers, it just, I can't put this quite into words, but it brings this inner emotion, and it's something that you know, an experience that you're tapping back into, and it's watching like on WGN in my living room. It's a second, you know, story of a two flat in Chicago, half a block from the L train, and you know, the sunlight's coming in, and I'm sitting there on the couch or the floor with my brother watching, you know, one of these sitcoms. Yeah. And it brings me back to that moment. The sitcom brings me back to an actual experience. And that's art and music is very powerful because of that. It brings us back to experiences and moments, and also sometimes maybe not so pleasant ones.
Yeah. So in music therapy, when we did a story on that, they really talked about a music therapist going into a nursing home, even working with dementia patients, and kind of finding out how old they were, and then trying to parse out, like, what would the music have been and that was popular when they were 13? And not everybody likes the same things, of course, and that will get harder as more music, you know, kind of, you know, floods. For, you know, a Gen Z person is going to have way more access than somebody, you know, who grew up in the 40s. But yes. When they find that music that happens to trigger that memory, how people will just completely come out of, in some cases, the room that they were locked into. And it's because you exactly what you said, bringing you right back into that space of when you were. And something about that age of 13 seems to be incredibly important. Mm. I kind of wish I'd watched more TV when I was that, you know. At the time, I didn't think that, you know, I thought it was good not to watch too much TV. But now I'm like, I don't remember any of those shows from when I was that age. I didn't watch TV then.
I watched way too much TV, and I wish I'd watched a little less. But I mean, like right now, if in my office the last few days, I've been listening, you know, to Belinda Carlisle on YouTube. And it's like, that's right in that era when I was, you know, 13 to 15.
Yeah.
And a little younger, the Go-Go's. And, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, I listen to Heaven is a Place on Earth by Belinda Carlisle, and it brings me back to somewhere. It just makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And music has that power. And I think that's why we don't want to relegate art when we're talking about science. I mean, people go down a scientific path sometimes, and they forget that art is what brings that experience. And we aren't just, you know, a mind in a jar.
Mm. And likewise, then, would you say we don't want to separate art from faith in the sense that, because I think there are some faith traditions that really question or challenge, you know, should you be listening to what kind of music should be? It should be praise music. It should be music that, you know, puts you in a certain space. What's lost when we sort of put a big wall up and say the only art that comes in is art that specifically targets a certain part of my life, which is, you know, my religious life?
Well, I would both affirm and challenge that. So I think it is important to affirm that, like, the type of music we listen to does affect us. And so if you're listening to something that is not helpful for you, maybe you should back off of that. Or the same with television shows. People will watch maybe extremely violent television shows and then wonder why they're anxious. Mm-hmm. Well, that does have an effect on us. We are human. We experience that in some way. But at the same time, we should open ourselves up to a range of music and a range of television, a range of art, so that we can experience that full, you know, palette of human experience.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Loffrey. Thanks for listening.